You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's that time of year when the clocks go back, pumpkins are carved, and people's appetite for ghost stories increases into the darker nights of autumn. Who better than Ruth Roper Wilde to join me as we dive into her latest book, The Roadmap of British Ghosts, Volume 2. With tales of ghost planes, spectral motor cars, haunted lanes, weird bridges, disappearing monks, and a couple of phantom hitchhikers, there's not much we don't cover in this episode. A big thank you as always to Ruth for rejoining me once again. Don't forget as well, Brennan Stahl's latest book, A Strange Little Place, has been updated and re-released, and I was humbled and honoured to ask the foreword for this new version. So check that out wherever good books are sold. But before we get to the show, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters on Patreon by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or clicking the link in the show notes as usual. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Let's join Ruth as she guides us around some of the UK's most haunted highways and byways. One of the joys of creating this show is discovering new authors, investigators and creators across the world and unlocking a whole plethora of accounts, encounters and much more. One such person has quickly become one of my favourite authors and guests, the marvellous Ruth Roper Wilde. In her brand new book, The Roadmap of British Ghosts, Volume 2, Ruth has collated another bumper collection of supernatural encounters across this haunted isle. Ruth, a wonderfully warm welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's always so nice to come and be on the show.
Absolutely. I'm very delighted that my pre-planning and booking you in coincided with your book being released a fortnight before we were due to talk.
It worked really well, didn't it?
Well, you said you promised me it'd be out by the end of September and you weren't wrong. So I'm always delighted with your punctuality, Ruth.
It's a good job somebody is, eh?
As you say on the back cover of the book, Ruth, I always have a little chuckle because you're very humble when you come to these things. And it's, as we were joking before we started this, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And the roadmap was a hefty volume anyway. I mean, the one thing I love about your work is you certainly get your value for money. If nothing else, if you're afraid of ghosts or anything, then you're in trouble. But you will guarantee several hundred pages of wonderful reports from all around the UK. And so I had a little chuckle on the back when you said if you'd have realised what was going to go down, you'd have titled the first volume, Volume 1, because obviously it was just the roadmap of British ghosts. But as with anything, especially when you're dealing with the paranormal, as soon as you release something, it's almost as if it triggers something in people's memories that they've somehow suppressed or put to one side that, oh yeah, actually I know something about something that happened round there. It might not be the same place, but it's just around the corner.
And that's exactly what happened. I wrote The Roadmap of British Ghosts, you know, the first one, thinking that it would be the definitive work on those ghosts that haunt our roads and byways. And I'd honestly dragged those stories over years looking for them. It was years of work getting that database together for the first roadmap. And of course, I started with the stories I'd found elsewhere and then went out trying to see if I could find people who'd actually experienced those hauntings and what have you up and down the various roads. And whilst writing it, I did get a few extras that went into it, of course. But I really thought I'd cracked it when I'm fool that I am, when I published it, because I'd emptied my database. I've got a database of road ghosts, and I'd emptied it into that book. And it was one of those feelings of, yay, I've done it. Then I wrote These Haunted Times Volume 1 and then These Haunted Times Volume 2. And by the time I'd written them, the blooming database for the road ghosts had filled back up again with people writing to me and saying, well, you know, I've read your roadmap, or you were asking about such and such for this latest book, but I saw a ghost on my way home from work or my way into town or whatever it was. So I'd say, okay, and I'd pop that into my back into my road ghosts database. And when I finished These Haunted Times Volume 2, I thought, I wonder if there's enough in there to do a small extra bit or maybe an addendum to the original roadmap. And I had a proper look at the database, thought, oh, that's a whole book again, isn't it? And, you know, it's funny you say about, you know, bumper number of hundreds of pages. I actually had to go through the roadmap volume two and be really brutal and cut some back out because it was getting so big that it would have made the cost of it absolutely prohibitive for people.
Yeah.
Because obviously the more pages there are in a book, the more expensive it is to create the book in physical form. You know, if you're going to buy it in actual paperback, the more pages, then the more expensive the paperback. And it was getting to the point where I thought, if I put that out, it's going to be way too much money for people. I'll have to strip some out. So, yes, some have gone back into the database. and at least I've learned my lesson now. Give everything a volume number.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a wonderful problem to have, because as I said on the introduction, Ruth, I discovered you 3 years ago by hearing you appear on another show when you, I think you first appeared on Howard Hughes' Unexplained. It was the first time I came across your work.
Yep.
This is your fourth appearance on Mysteries and Monsters, so congratulations, you're in very esteemed company.
Woohoo!
But one of the things I've always loved about your work is that we're not just talking about things that happened 100 years ago, 50 years ago. I would say the vast majority of your reports are in the modern era. These are things that have happened 6 months ago, even in some respects. I know we've had some very recent reports in previous works, and I know there are a couple of very recent reports in this latest one as well, Ruth. So are you still surprised, as we hit your sixth book, that there seems to be sometimes this perception that, I don't know where it's come from, but often people say, oh, nobody sees ghosts anymore.
Well, do you know, I find that an astonishing perception now. I really do, because exactly as you've said, I really only like including stories that people have seen within my lifetime. So, you know, within the sort of last five decades, she says, without giving too much away about her age. because, and it all stems to when I was a child growing up, and one of our houses, you know, as we've spoken about before, had a poltergeist, and we had a lot of very strange things happening in the house, and I wanted to read about this, you know, what are people experiencing? Now, this was back in the days before the computer. Yes, people, I really am that old. So I'd have to go to a library or a bookshop or whatever, and all I could find was stories about clanky old knights in dusty old castles, you know, from 18 something or other. And frankly, as a teenager living with a poltergeist, I didn't care.
Mm.
You know, I was like, I don't want to read about that. I want to read what people have got in their houses that is switching the lights on and off and switching the cooker on and off and moving things about.
Mm.
And that's where my interest came from. What are people experiencing now? So that tends to be my cutoff point for what gets into the books, is that it's, I need things that have been seen within the last few decades, and preferably that have been seen several times by several different people over a period of time. They're the ones that really, really get to fascinate me when I can find more than one correlation for something. But yes, so almost all of them, I think probably a few have slipped through that are older than that, but almost all of them will be within the last few decades that they have been experienced. Mm. And some are, like you say, might only be weeks old at the point that I publish the book.
Yes. I mean, this is the thing. You always push your deadline to the very edge. But I suppose it's a wonderful problem to have, Ruth, is that sometimes you will get a story that's so good, you would be crazy not to try and squeeze it in as close to the edit as you can.
Well, that's the problem. And, you know, if it fascinates me, then I kind of selfishly, I suppose, assume that it might fascinate other people. And that's so good, it's just got to go in. And I find myself, I'm in the middle of proofreading a book or doing the final edit or doing the The bit I hate the most, which is the, you know, laying out of the text, making sure the text is in all the right places.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody will send me a story and I've got to fit it in. And of course, it means shuffling the text around again. But I still, like you say, I still think, well, I've got to fit it in. I've got to fit it in somehow. Because they just, well, it's just my fascination with it, I think.
Mm.
It never fails to amaze me, interest me, engage me. And that's what just keeps me with the passion of keeping on going and keeping on going. It never gets boring to me. So sorry, guys, there'll be more books to come. You just have to keep reading.
Well, that's excellent news for us all, Ruth. So I'm delighted. I was going to say, when you were talking about what you'd have to cut out, I thought, well, we know there's a volume three there then.
I wouldn't bet that there wouldn't be.
Well, I have to show my bias here, Ruth, and say that the first story I want to talk about is Sheffield, because as I said to you before we started, whenever I get one of your books, the first thing I will do is turn to Yorkshire or Derbyshire, because I'm on near enough the border, so I always like to look and see if anybody's reported anything near me or there's anything I can visit, because one of the other things since I've started doing this show, I just visit haunted locations and strange places all over the place now, and obviously living where I live, I'm very lucky that there's quite a lot.
Yeah.
And so I was delighted to see in this latest book that you have touched on one of my favourite local paranormal situations that we've got around this part of Sheffield and the Peak District, which is this situation we have with people seeing ghost planes. Now, I know exactly the location because I've driven through this place hundreds of times, Ruth. Olabar, which is just on the southeastern edge of Sheffield, as you approach the Peak District. And this is the ghost plane hotspot of the Peak District. So, as we were joking beforehand, this is a book about ghosts on roads.
Yes.
And yet, here we have this wonderful story about someone seeing what they can only presume to be a phantom plane.
Yes, I know I was stretching the definition to its absolute limit. But the trouble is, I'm unlikely to ever get enough ghost plane stories, I think, to write a book specifically about ghost planes. And this chap had written to me and I just thought, well, it's got to go in somewhere. It's got to go in a book somewhere. And it is flying over roads. It's not in a building. Most of my other books, the ghosts are in a building of some description.
Yep.
And the road ghosts, they're all out in the open. You know, they're either on roads or tracks or byways. So, hey, up in the air. That's fine. It can fit in. So I stretched my definition as far as it would possibly go, simply because, you know, this chap had written to me with the story. He loves reading my books. He loves listening to the podcast. He's a commercial pilot. And he will often ask other pilots if they've ever seen anything odd, because they get talking, because he himself is so interested in the paranormal. And he remembers talking to one young pilot, you know, who was quite young and was flying with his father in the cockpit. And they've got a light aircraft that they were flying. I may well use wrong terminology here because I'm in no way aviation knowledgeable. When they saw below their plane a big four-engine bomber pass beneath them, and as they sort of looked down in astonishment, it literally just disappeared. Mm. And this young pilot had told my correspondent, a commercial pilot, about this sighting and said he's never been able to reconcile my limited understanding of planes, and please feel free to correct me, anybody, but it should be quite unusual for one plane to fly below another plane.
Mm.
Because I think they're supposed to stay out of each other's airspace or something, aren't they?
Yes. You're supposed to have a minimum distance, either if you're even if you're in the same location, you're supposed to be several thousand feet apart.
Yes. So, and I don't think it was, you know, close enough to be a danger to them or anything, but it was definitely closer than several thousand feet from the way he described it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just disappeared. So that to me was fascinating. And, you know, it had definitely happened, you know, although he couldn't remember the date because he didn't think he'd asked the young lad for the date. But it was definitely within the last sort of, you know, 10 years or so that he was speaking to this guy.
Mm.
So I'd gone on and done what I usually do, which is go to see if I can find anything about the area, and so on. And of course, I'd then come across all the other stories there are, as you've mentioned, just how famous this particular ghost plane actually is, and was able to ascertain that most of the other stories say that the plane that's seen as the ghost plane is a Dakota.
Yes.
Which is apparently a twin-engined airplane, and was primarily used as a transporter. So, again, forgive my lack of aviation knowledge, but a transporter must be quite a big plane.
Yep.
And it looked quite big in the pictures of it that I looked up. And, you know, a four-engine bomber is quite a big plane because you're looking at a Hercules or something like that, aren't you?
Yeah.
Probably. So two large planes, but a pilot would know the difference between a four-engined craft and a two-engine craft, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Somebody inexperienced like me might make a mistake, but you wouldn't think a pilot would. So is it the same plane? And I did have somebody explain to me that there is a real-life Hercules that does do training flights over that area. So, you know, an actual real one, not a ghost one. Is it possible that they accidentally flew over that Hercules when either the Hercules shouldn't have done or they shouldn't have done or something? I don't know. But it doesn't explain why it seemed to disappear. Because, again, you know, if you're a pilot in a plane, you're not going to think the plane below you has suddenly disappeared. And if it did and you were pretty sure it was a real plane, you know, you'd be notified there was a plane below you, or your radar was saying the plane was below you or something and it suddenly disappeared. You'd be calling it in as a problem, I would have thought. So I don't know. I don't know why they saw a four-engine plane, and the ghost plane that most people see seems to be a Dakota twin-engine plane. Can't explain that discrepancy. But there it is. I'm always really insistent in my books. I don't change what people tell me.
Yep.
You know, if that's what they've told me, then that's what goes in the book. So I'm not going to try and fit what they said into what they're supposed to have seen or anything. The fact is that this commercial pilot remembers being told it was a four-engined bomber. So that's what we've put in, and we won't really know why there's that discrepancy in what other people see.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because whatever people are seeing, they're seeing something.
Yeah. I think this goes back to the first reported sighting of one of these alleged ghost planes around here was 1948, Ruth.
Wow.
And it's been going on ever since. And occasionally there'll be spikes, which is one of the weird things about this. It doesn't happen all the time. You'll probably not hear one of these stories for 5 years, 10 years sometimes. And occasionally there'll be a flap, ironically, as we're talking about ghost planes, where there'll be a spate of sightings over a 1 or 2 year period. Where this particular sighting occurred at Ola Bar is basically at the beginning of entering part of the Peak District. It takes you up to a place called Castleton and Hope, which I know you're aware of because you've visited the area.
Yeah.
There are several dozen sightings over the years in that particular area of people, usually in the day, out walking, people who aren't staggering home from the pub or whatever, or driving in a car. These are people walking on the road or taking a Leslie Stroll, because obviously it's a very popular area for hikers and walkers, because it's the Peak District, which is a phenomenally popular area. So I've always loved these stories, because these are things that, one of the things that always strikes people, a lot of the witnesses, Ruth, when they see them, always report the fact that there's no noise at all. It's silence. It's like they're in a bubble.
Which is amazing, isn't it? Because really, any aircraft, unless it's really, really, really high up, you know, on a sort of transatlantic sort of flight, you can hear them, can't you?
Yes, yes, very much so. And the other aspect of this is that this area, the Peak District, there is a specific area known as the Dark Peak, which obviously makes it as ominous as it should be. And that is, this area has had at least 100 plane crashes.
Wow.
Over the years, there's loads of, I mean, you can actually take trips, you can go on a walk around there. There is wreckage all over the place up there. Still, a lot of flights during the Second World War crash around there. There's a very famous story about a, this is one of those stories from the Second World War where you think, goodness me, where I think it was a submarine spotting plane had been out in the Bay of Biscay and was told to come home, back to base, and they were coming back and they lost. It all went horribly wrong. I can't remember what happened. Oh yeah, they got lost and they weren't sure where they were and they're running out of fuel. They weren't going to make it back. So they abandoned the plane. All the crew got out safely. However, the plane was designed to spot submarines, and if it spotted a submarine, it would drop a depth charge on them, Ruth.
Oh, grief.
So they abandoned this plane with I think it had 16 depth charges on, so it essentially became a flying bomb. And they abandoned just before it flew over Manchester. And by luck or good judgment or pure chance, it managed to just keep its elevation till it got past Manchester out towards Glossop, and it hit the hillside and blew up. And nobody got killed.
That was lucky.
But there's loads of these reports where people got mysteriously lost, people doing training flights, and they would fly through strange clouds, or because the weather changes so quickly up there as well. Even experienced pilots can be flying along, and then all of a sudden a bank of cloud appears and they lose their bearings and unfortunately hit the ground, hit the moors.
Yeah, it's just funny to meet them almost, hasn't it? Yeah.
There are reports not only of people seeing ghostly planes. There's a very famous report of several people have become really obsessed with this particular area and have mapped all these people and left trinkets and flowers and things for the servicemen that lost, because obviously a lot of them were Canadian and American servicemen, strangely enough, who died over that particular area. There's a very famous story of one guy who took some Welsh crash spotters up there in the 70s, I think it was. And he took them up to this particular spot and he was showing them, because he'd found one of the airmen's watches, I think it was. And he returned it to the family in America, sent it them. So he took these guys up and he was showing them where they got it. And he bent over to show them. And when he stood up, they were like 20 yards away and they were off running down the hill. And he was like, hang on, what's going on here? So he managed to catch up with them at the bottom where they parked. And he said, what was going on? And they said to him, as he bent down, this airman appeared behind him, looking down at him. And as he stood up, it disappeared, but they just went. And they said, thank you very much. We're not going back. Take care, got in the car, they drove off.
Wow. Nice of them to abandon him to the ghost.
Well,
good job it didn't have any malicious intent going on, but blimey.
So, yeah, so if the weather's good and you ever fancy a strange trip around there, these sites are located, they're well known. If you go on YouTube, you can see these particular areas where they've just left the wreckage as a mark of respect, which is one of those strange things as well, that they came and took the bodies, but they left the wreckage, Ruth, which I'm not really sure about, to be honest. I don't know whether it was because it was the end of the Second World War and it was rationing and they just thought it was too expensive to remove it all, but they're still there 60, 70 years later. There's bits of planes just scattered all across the moorland up there.
I'm definitely going to add that to my bucket list for somewhere to go and drive along.
Ironically, there's a few places, as we were joking, obviously it's not far from the well-known cave, the Devil's Arse. There's also the Devil's Elbow, the Devil's Road. So it's one of those places, and it's obviously an area with a long history of UFOs and strange lights in the sky, and the Peak District is full of loads of myths and legends as well. So this particular modern addition to the whole mythos of this area is something that's fascinated me for ages. There's just so many great stories of people seeing things.
It's amazing how some areas are so rife for the paranormal or the supernatural, however you want to put it. And there definitely seems to be some pockets that are more active than others, doesn't it?
Yeah. It is strange as well, because people will write books about the ghosts of Derbyshire and Sheffield and the Peak District, and they will never touch this subject. So it's one of those that I think, once you, as happened to you, Ruth, once you find out about it, you suddenly go, hang on a minute. How did I not know about this?
Well, yes, because I'd never heard of it. Like I say, until I started researching, as I always do when somebody gives me a story, I start looking to see if I can find anything to correlate with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did come across, you know, mentions of this ghost plane. But yes, I didn't really come across many books written about it. I have to say it was mostly some newspaper articles that I found.
Mm.
So interesting.
Yes, I think there was one book written about 30 years ago by a local author, and I don't think anybody knows if you can still get a copy. I've searched for it through hell and high water, and every time I go to anywhere around there like Batewell or Castleton or anything, I'll dive into a charity shop and hopefully stumble across one. But unfortunately, as of yet, I've been unsuccessful.
Well, fingers crossed.
So, moving away from my locality and letting the rest of the British Isles have a shoe in here, as always, Ruth, is there situations where you find yourself putting one of your appeals out, because obviously you're very good at sort of advertising the fact that you are searching specific locations. Have you found with this one there's one of those particular locations where you just get swamped with stories about something, or is it one of those that there's nothing really that stands out? Because I know when we've spoken about a couple of other places in the book, you've been overcome sometimes with the amount of stories that come in for one particular area when you were perhaps not even aware of what people were seeing.
Do you know, I don't think there is a standout one in this particular book that has dozens of sightings like I've had in some of my other books. There are several in there that got a lot of engagement, and there are several in there where people not exactly the same place, but in the same kind of area. One that springs to mind is on Anglesey, in Wales, at Holyhead.
Yes.
And I was asking about, somebody had told me, you know, in response to one of my requests at some point, and it had gone onto the database, there's a tiny, tiny lane. I can't remember off the top of my head which road it runs from, but it's in the book. And it was one of these tiny little lanes that, well, it's a footpath, not a road lane, a footpath lane, that runs behind the gardens of people's houses, you know, the sort of thing I mean. And this particular one, it went off a side street in Holyhead, ran along the side of somebody's house, then took a right-hand turn behind the gardens of the houses, and then a couple of short turns around other people's fences and things.
Mm.
And then at one point it ran alongside what used to be a health clinic and then carried on past the houses and popped out on another road.
Mm.
And this little tiny lane was said to be haunted. And the original one that I was trying to track down wasn't terribly specific about haunted by what exactly.
Mm.
There was some mention it might be a highwayman and a horse, which, like, well, you wouldn't fit a horse down that lane for a start. But when I went out, I got quite a lot of responses on that one for people in the streets around that lane. And also somebody who at one point had worked as an ambulance driver for that clinic. And he said the clinic was haunted. The clinic itself has long since been pulled down, and there's now a little cul-de-sac of more modern houses in it.
Mm.
And I also had somebody who wrote, as a child, used to go and play in the garages that were behind the clinic, that belonged to the clinic, but kind of half disused. They didn't have any particular use for them. They used to sort of store old stuff in them. And they'd gone running into one of these garages one day, as kids will do, you know, and there was an old woman standing in the corner of the garage.
Mm.
And they'd all sort of legged it. But various other people in... And when you looked on the map, it was all within a sort of... maybe a half mile at most radius of this lane.
Yeah.
You know, the streets either side of it. Unfortunately, like I found with a lot of places in Wales, people who live locally know it by one name, and that's not the name it's called on Google Maps, so it makes it very hard for me to pin locations down sometimes.
Yes.
As far as I could make out from what people were telling me, it was all within this half mile radius. And they were seeing various different figures. You know, it wasn't necessarily ever the same figure, but there were quite a lot all in that one small location, which is, you know, again, it just makes you really think, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I mean, I recently visited Wales again for the first time in a very long time for a brief trip, and took in two haunted castles and a haunted house, and sadly didn't see anything. But so I wasn't too far away from that. And I think... It's one of those things when we come to the British Isles, Wales often gets overlooked, Ruth, for its haunted history, for some reason. I'm not sure why, because it's chock full of castles and legends. So I'm always surprised whenever you see anybody sort of focusing, who's from outside of the UK, focusing on Britain's ghosts. They very rarely bother with Wales, which I think's deeply unfair.
Well, it's really odd, you know, because I actually struggle with Wales and Scotland.
Mm.
I've said this before, because I don't know whether it's something about the way social media is, you know, habitually used or viewed or whatever in the areas.
Mm.
But you can find all sorts of, as you say, myths and legends and old tales from both those locations, Scotland and Wales.
Mm.
But finding somebody who's seen something in modern times is much, much harder, despite that wealth of, you know, legend and myth and so on, and all the old locations and, like you say, the castles and all sorts.
Mm.
And quite often when I go out on either Welsh social media or Scottish social media, I don't get very many responses. I did have somebody say to me once, maybe it's because in those areas, in the kind of older areas where, you know, families might have lived for many generations and so on, actually, the paranormal is much more accepted than elsewhere.
Yes.
So it's almost like me writing and saying, did anybody have a fried egg for breakfast this week? And everybody kind of goes, oh, God, we're not answering that post. How boring is that?
Yeah.
Of course everybody had a fried egg this week, you know? So me saying, has anybody seen a ghost here? Is like, yes, of course we did. Why are you asking? And they don't bother responding. And I thought, well, do you know, it's always possible that that is the case.
Mm.
So I'm always thrilled. So if anybody's from Wales or Scotland, please take note of this. I'm always thrilled when I manage to get people engaging with me about ghosts in Wales or Scotland, because there must be such a wealth, you know, with how many legends and how historic it is and so on.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm always really pleased when I get them. And it's dropped into my mind while I was speaking. It was called the Priory Clinic.
Mm.
And like I say, that's long since been demolished. But that's where the lane ran, next to where that used to be.
Yeah, it is funny. In my day job, I speak to, obviously I work for a rather large company in the United Kingdom, in my normal, boring day-to-day job, Ruth. So I will speak to somebody. I remember recently speaking to one of our staff who lived on a very infamous Scottish street where there was an infamous poltergeist case from the 1960s.
Oh.
And I chuckled when he gave me his address. I'm not even going to bother trying to do the accent because I'll embarrass both the person and myself, Ruth. That he went, oh, so you've heard of this place, have you? And I said, oh, yeah. And I told him why. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, the whole street's haunted. It wasn't just her house. And I said, oh, really? He said, oh, yeah, my mate lives on that street. He lives three doors down. He said, and they always had stuff going on. He says, it's still going on now.
And that does kind of resonate with what I was told, that, yeah, it's so common that why are you bothering talking about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's as common as having a fried egg for your breakfast. It's happening all the time.
Yeah, yeah. He was just surprised that someone from Sheffield would know what this street was. And I said, well, it's one of the most famous poltergeist cases in Britain. And he went, well, yeah. He said, for us, it's just, as you just say, he said, well, you know, it happens around here.
Yeah.
Just like water off a duck's back.
Yeah, absolutely. Just commonplace and accepted. Yeah. Mm.
Well, I think, seeing as we've touched on Scotland, Ruth, one of the strangest stories in here actually features yourself.
Do you know, this fascinated me. Honestly, this was just like, we were saying earlier about people just out driving, people out walking and, you know, see things or hear things or whatever and how strange it can be. And this was one of those occasions. I love Scotland and, you know, the very remote high highlands. I think it's gorgeous up there.
Beautiful.
Yeah, just think it's wonderful. Not particularly my husband's cup of tea.
Mm.
You know. So the first time I went up would have been 2019. We were having a discussion that particular year, where should we go on holiday this year? Because we normally go on holiday in the UK somewhere because we've got the dogs.
Yeah.
Just one dog now, but, you know. And it means, you know, we always take the dogs with us. So, and I said, oh, we could go to Scotland again. And he kind of wrinkled his nose in that, do we have to way? And I said, oh, did you not particularly like this? Well, it's okay. He said, but, you know, it's just lots of mountains and, you know, it's not really my thing. And I kind of pulled a face, oh, but I loved it. I really want to go to Scotland. I said, well, nobody's stopping you. And I thought, actually, he's right. Nobody is. It doesn't have to be both of us that goes. I'd hate it if he dragged me off to somewhere I didn't like. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So I booked my first big adventure to Scotland that year and enjoyed it so much that I went again this year, but to a different location.
Mm.
And for those that don't know me, I have got a mobility impairment, so I can't walk huge distances, but I can get my car in some pretty amazing places if I try hard enough. And I'm pretty fearless and will go pretty much anywhere. So I'd chosen the location that was, it was a good 10-hour drive from here, and the little holiday cottage I was staying in with my dog was sat completely on its own on the edge of a lock in the middle of nowhere, nobody anywhere nearby. My idea of heaven, yeah. Loads of places to explore. But of course, the second day I was there, so I arrived on the first day having driven the 500 miles to get there, and I thought, I don't really want to drive too far today, having done such a long drive yesterday. So I had a look at the map and I could see that there was a road not far from where I was that was a dead end road, but it went through a nature reserve called Glenhurich. And I may well be pronouncing that wrong. I apologise. And I thought, well, that's handy. It's only about 10 miles long, this piece of road, and it's only about 8 miles from where I am, the start of it. So that's a nice, easy little drive out. And it so happened that near the start of it, there was a cafe selling breakfast, which was even better. So off me and the dog trot in the car, stop at the cafe, eat the breakfast. He very kindly helped me by eating the sausages. And then we jump in the car and off we go up this dead end piece of road, which is essentially about 8 or 10 miles long, something like that. Goes up one side of a mountain and down the other side in a very narrow, with passing places, one in four in places. Hardly anybody uses it because it doesn't go anywhere. Road that's very, very steep, very obviously wonderful views. As you go over the top of the mountain and down the other side, you enter this nature reserve park, which is a forest that has not been touched for probably a couple of hundred years by the looks of it. And it's the most wonderful bit of a drive because you're dropping down a very, very steep road through this forest where everything's covered in moss. So the light is this weird green, even though it was a bright sunny day, it's this weird green through the trees and the moss. So I was driving along with the windows down and really enjoying seeing it. And eventually you drop down off the mountain to the level of the loch and you drive all along the side of the loch. And on this particular day, it was quite a warm day. The midges weren't yet out, so I could have the windows down. And the loch itself was perfectly still. It's only a very, very small loch, really small. So I stopped several times and got out of the car to take a photograph to get the reflection in the lock, you know. And eventually you come to the end of the lock and there's a little bridge over it. So I drove over this bridge. And as I drove over it, it became immediately apparent that it was a metal bridge with big metal plates laid loosely on it. So much so that as you drive over it, and I'm in quite a big SUV type car.
Yeah.
The banging and clanging of these plates was something quite alarming. And I had that horrible moment of, oh my God, should I have got out of the car and checked this was safe to drive across before I drove across it? Oh, well, too late now. Keep going. So I drove across it. It was fine. Carried on. The road goes on for about another, maybe half a mile or so past that point and ends in a little car park next to a house. Couldn't tell whether anybody was living in the house or not. It was all shut up and there weren't any cars with it, but whether there was somebody living there, I don't know. There were two cars in the car park, nobody in them. So I presume they were hikers who'd arrived earlier and gone off up into the deep mountains. So I thought, oh, there's nothing really to get out of the car for here. I know. I'll go back to that bridge. I'll park up next to it. I'll walk into the middle of the bridge because I'll get some lovely views up the lock from the middle of the bridge, you know, with it, all this nice reflection on the water. So I duly do, and I drive back down and I go clang, 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 clang across the bridge again. Reverse into a gateway to a field right next to the bridge. Get out of my car. I think, oh, I'll put my walking shoes on. Let's do that. Walk round to the back of the car. Open the boot to let Red, my dog, out. Now, Red is a Belgian Malinois, highly trained, really, really well-behaved dog. He never, ever jumps out of that car without permission. So I open the boot of the car, and much to my astonishment, he jumps out of the boot. And I'm sort of, what the earth do you think you're playing at him? And he stands there by the back of the car and looks at me and I look at him and I bend down to put his leads on. And I'm in quite a soft voice, sort of chastising him, saying, what did you do that for? You know, you're not allowed to do that, you bad lad. And he's sort of looking at me. And as I'm bending down doing this, I hear an engine and the bridge starts clanging like it had when my car had gone over it. The noise of the engine made me think quad bike. So it was quite a high revvy sounding engine. And the thought that, so I'm bent over, my dog clipping his lead on as this is happening, and my thought was, oh, I hope that quad bike doesn't want to come into this gateway that I've reversed into. I better look to see if I'm making somebody cross by being parked here.
Yeah.
So this thought's gone through my head. The bridge is clanging. I can hear this engine. I go from the bent over position to the upright position. So that takes what, half a second? And in that time, as I stand up and turn to the bridge, the noise stopped completely. Utter silence. Not a thing to be seen. And the bridge is only 20 yards, if that. I doubt it was even that. It was probably 10 yards from where I'm standing. And I just stood there looking at it thinking, what? Because I can't describe to you how loud this clanging is, this metal bridge. So then your brain sort of kicks in and you start trying to rationalise it and you think, well, maybe it was a quad bike who was coming along the fields beside the river and went over the end of the bridge and then on down without actually crossing the bridge. Oh, I bet that's what it was. So I walk across the bridge, Red's on the lead at this point, trotting along beside me. Get to the other side and realise that, no, that's not possible because there's a fence either side. So there's no gateways. There's no way a vehicle could be driving along the bank of the lock and over the road and then carry on because it's fenced.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought, right. Oh, maybe it was a boat then. You know how your mind starts to reach for sort of ever more ridiculous suggestions, but trying to find an explanation. Perhaps a boat went under the bridge and made it reverberate and clang, and that's the engine. So I walk into the middle, look over the edge, and realise that actually the river here, at this point of the year at least, is so shallow, I doubt whether you could have got a kayak down it, let alone anything with a boat with an engine on it,
yeah.
Because it was literally just a few inches deep. And then I sort of started to think, well, even if it was a boat or something going and it wasn't coming along the road, why can't I hear it now? I am in the middle of nowhere. I am 8 miles from the nearest civilization of any description, which is a tiny, tiny little place called Strontian. I'm 8 miles from it. Any engine I should be able to hear coming and going for quite some distance, and yet I can't hear it. And I only heard it for that split second. And as I start to rationalise that out, I also realise that what I am listening to is Red whimpering and crying beside me. And I look down at him and realise that he's desperately unhappy and tugging, trying to get back to the car. So I think, oh, he must be unhappy, this metal bridge. Walk him off the metal bridge, and I walk up and down the lane a bit, trying to see if I could hear anything. The entire time, he was crying and trying to pull me back to the car. So after about 20 minutes, I went back to the car, put him back in it, drove on off up the road. About halfway back up this road, heading back, you know, back towards civilisation, there is a little car park that I'd noticed with a, you know, one of those information boards.
Yeah.
So I pulled in to see if it gave any information, got Red out of the car again. And this time all he wanted to do was get his ball out of the car and play with his car and was trying to persuade me to play ball with him and just his normal self again.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's really odd then, because whatever it was, Red was reacting to it. And whatever it was, I clearly heard an engine and that bridge clearly started clanging, but only for a split second before I stood up and it all stopped. No idea. So there you go. Loch Doyleen. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but I looked it all up and I can't find a single thing about it being haunted. But if anybody from that location knows anything about it, I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, as well, obviously due to the experience, Ruth, it would have to be a recent haunting, surely. Because obviously, you know, without wishing to sound churlish, if we're talking about some form of motorised transport that disappears into the ether, then clearly something must have occurred there recently then.
Well, I mean, I ride a motorbike, so I'm fairly used to motorbike engines. I've ridden a lot of quad bikes. So the fact that it made me think of quad bike, the sound of the engine made me think quad bike, means that either it was the sound of a quad bike, or it was one of those other little utility vehicles you get that are similar to a quad bike.
Yes.
Or I suppose there's a possibility that it's a much, much older vehicle from, you know, the early 1900s that may or may not have had a high revy engine. I don't know, never heard one of them running. But whatever it was the sound of a high revy engine like a quad bike would have. And that would tend to suggest something more modern, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the location, the environment, the fact that it's peaceful, it's quiet. Even if you had mistakenly heard something, but, you know, I'm playing devil's advocate here, Ruth.
And there was not another human sound.
Exactly.
In total, I must have spent about 3 hours driving up and down this bit of road and getting in and out and, you know, sightseeing and what have you in total. And in that whole time, I saw one other vehicle right near the start of the road. But the whole time I was along the main length of that road, I never saw another person. I never saw another vehicle. I never heard another sound of human habitation at all. All you could hear was birds and insects. So any sound of human habitation would carry quite a way.
Yeah.
You know, and you would have heard it as background noise, but there just was none. I mean, that's part of the reason I enjoy it up there so much, because you can get to these places where there is nothing to hear other than nature, you know.
I mean
I wasn't looking for ghosts that day. I wasn't thinking of ghosts. I was thinking of taking photographs, so I have no explanation, but it was interesting. And it wasn't scary. I wasn't at all nerved or scared. There was no heavy atmosphere that I picked up, but Red was definitely very uncomfortable with it.
Well, that's always for me a really good indicator of something peculiar going on, is how animals react. And for him to have that reaction in that particular area and then a mile up the road be absolutely fine and wanting to play ball again, you know, when you own animals or you've got pets, be it cats or dogs or whatever, you know their personalities, you know how they behave normally, you know that how they will react in certain situations. Most people with dogs will know that it's only if their dog reacts in a very strange way that it seems to elevate something going on, because normally most dogs are very playful, and if they're not, then you tend to think that they're off it a little bit. You know, they might be off their food, or they might have a bit of an upset tummy, or they're just not feeling it. Whereas if you're out for a walk and your dog starts to want to go back, there are very few dogs that when you set off going for a walk, they'll go until you get bored more often than not.
Absolutely. And Red comes ghost hunting with me a lot.
Yes.
You know, this is a dog who does a lot of ghost hunting. and he has reacted in some places over the years, but he's never reacted with fear.
Mm.
And this, he was definitely unsettled there. Something was really unsettling him. So, yeah, curious.
Very strange. And like you say, it's weird that clearly this bridge is there for a reason, Ruth. So obviously some people must come through that part occasionally. But
well, there is definitely the house at the far end.
Mm.
So, that, you know, at the far end of the road, there is a house. And as you go through that road, you know, up one side of the mountain, down the other, there's a couple of properties set back, you know, little farm buildings. And I think a couple of them might be holiday homes now.
Mm.
But I was going, you know, this was it was the 2nd of May this year.
Mm.
So I was ahead of the holiday season, you know, and everywhere was only just starting to open up properly.
Yeah.
And I, you know, there just weren't other people around on that day when I went through it. But yes, the bridge is used because, there is this car park at the far end and there is a building there. So it's obviously used.
Mm.
But yeah, what that was that day, who knows? It was going in the book, though.
Absolutely. I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all. I think often when I read your books as well, I'm often struck, because I know we once had a brain fog together when we couldn't remember the name of the most haunted village in Britain, which is Pluckley.
Yes.
See, I'm prepared this time. And but what I've noticed is there are certain places that until I'd read your books, I'd never really heard of. And you just think, what on earth is going on in this particular place? And one of them that's always struck me, and you mention it once again in this book, is Risley, which is in North Bedfordshire, I believe.
Yes.
Now, this is not a very big place. And I think previously you were talking about there's supposed to be one of those wonderful stories about an animal ghost there with a horse-related curious haunting going on there. But the story that you've got in this one is one of those stories. I love ghost stories like this, because once again, we're talking about a mode of transport, and this one features a ghost car.
Yes, yes, and it is odd. You are right that it's very odd that Risley has featured so often in my books. You know, I just keep picking up stories from there, and as you say, most of them are about this horse entity that seems to be very active in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Risley itself is tiny little village, really. But because I write about it so much, this person actually wrote to me saying, well, I haven't ever seen your ghost horse that you go on about, but she and her workmate used to work the night shift at this particular time. It was about 10 years or so ago, so we're looking 2011, 2012, summertime. Driving from Oakington to Yarlswood using the back lanes, which takes them through Risley, or just, you know, past Risley right onto the little lanes there, late at night, because obviously they're working the night shift and they're on the way, and they see coming towards them a beautiful cream coloured car. And it's one of these old style cars, like big old vintage cars, you know, the ones with the big swept wheel arches and
yes,
running boards.
Yeah,
yeah,
sort
of, yeah. You know what I mean? So perhaps something like a vintage Rolls Royce or something of that ilk.
Mm.
It seemed to be coming towards them quite fast. So she pulls in as tight as she can in a little modern car, but it never seemed to acknowledge that they pulled in or slowed down. It just kept barreling towards them, this car. And she says there was this horrible moment when they just knew that there wasn't room for it to get past, and it wasn't slowing down, so it was going to clip them. And a split second later, instead of hitting them, the car just drives through them. So they're in a little van and it just drives through them. She said it was the strangest thing she could imagine, that it just happened. I'm not sure I would have been quite that calm. Strangest thing ever. I think I'd have turned the air blue at that point. But yeah, she says it actually just barreled through them. And it is curious because there's another location not that far away from there. I'm trying to think. Colmworth, which has a grey Bentley, vintage Bentley, that's said to be seen. And I thought, well, cream-coloured, grey, not so far apart in colours.
Mm.
Old vintage car, Bentley, Rolls-Royce, very similar. And I wonder if it's the same vehicle that's seen in the two locations, I must admit.
Mm.
So I shall wait with bated breath to see if anybody else has seen that one within the last few years, because that, yeah, again, in that same area.
I think when you have a witness that comes forward when they've had these kind of encounters, it kind of removes any shadow of doubt as to what they may or may not have seen, Ruth, because often people say, oh, they saw a shape by the side of the road, or something ran across the road in front of them, misperception, streetlights, whatever. If people are reporting either seeing ghostly vehicles or, you know, I always like a ghost on a bicycle, I have to say, as well, because there are a few of those wonderful stories from around the UK. But when people are having encounters with phantom cars, I think that completely removes any possible misidentification, especially this one where the car went through them.
Yes.
That it can't be misperception. It can't be shadows of the light. It literally takes it out of easy explanation into the realms of why is it this particular area where you have a ghost car? Because with the greatest of respect, car accidents and fatal ones happen all around the UK.
Yep.
And have done for since the invention of the motor car arrived here just over 100 years ago. So there are numerous car accidents all over the world, famous places where you've got accident black spots, where there are certain locations that become notorious, Ruth, for unfortunate loss of life of drivers and pedestrians on occasion. So when you have, once again, this quiet little village seems to have now got a ghost car as well, you think, well, what yep. makes this particular car accident or this car so attached to this particular area? Because I'm sure there have been worse accidents with a larger loss of life in different parts of the UK where we don't get any of these reports. And for me, I often think, well, why is that happening? What's caused that to become this residual, repeating phantom motor car?
Well, you see, I would counter that by saying, well, you're making an assumption there that the car that's appearing now as a ghost car, if you like, was involved in some sort of accident.
Mm.
And you're, you know, due respect, making an assumption that it's repeating behaviour.
Yeah.
And we don't actually know that when you think about it.
Mm.
All we know is that some people in different bits of different lanes in that location are seeing a car that has a description that's close enough that you think, I think that could be the same car.
Yeah.
So to me, what that says is this is not necessarily a car that was involved in some accident or, you know, something traumatic happened. This might just be something that for whatever reason has either imprinted a memory of a journey on the landscape, or are we seeing a time slip?
Yeah.
You know, is that area actually prone to time slip? So you get a momentary glimpse of one particular time that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just sort of some kind of echo?
Yeah.
You know, the possibilities when you really start to think about it are myriad.
Mm.
And all we can say for sure is that I can't for the life of me imagine why anybody would write to me the way this particular witness did to simply tell me this story. They haven't asked for their real name to be used, so the name that's in the book is a pseudonym, as it says in my prologue. You know, I usually use pseudonyms.
Yep.
So they're not getting anything from it. I don't pay witnesses to write to me. I wouldn't be able to afford to, apart from anything else, because, you know, there's so many in my books, it costs 1,000. So they're not getting anything from me.
Yeah.
They're not getting anything in the way of a little bit of fame or, you know, you 15 minutes in the spotlight or any of that, because this isn't their real name in the book. So they're not identifiable as an individual. Only I know who it is that wrote to me. So I can't see any gain for them in just telling me an outright lie. So that means you're left with, well, then they're telling me what they perceived had happened to them, just as I've just explained to you what I perceived happened to me in Scotland, you know?
Yeah.
So they're giving me as truthful an account as they can of what they experienced. And that leaves us with, right, so we can fairly safely dismiss outright lying. And we're fairly sure that their account is going to be as accurate as any account is likely to be given the vagaries of human memory and so on. So that leaves us with, well, then what on earth is causing it? Because it happened. And therein lies the ever, ever circling fascination for me with the paranormal, you know, because you do find yourself going round and round with that, but it happened. I can't say what the explanation necessarily is, but it happened, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you point out quite correctly, Ruth, it doesn't necessarily mean it's an accident. It could be somebody who loved that journey, for all I know.
Loved that car.
Yeah.
Yeah, could have been two people in the car who were so in love. We just don't know, do we?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, what makes it repeat or what makes us glimpse it? Mm. All we can say is that it is being glimpsed.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, even to the extent where it drives through your blooming van. Yeah. And I'd just like to say, because I go to Risley quite a bit, there happens to be a shooting ground there that we go to a lot. Please, please, whatever your reason is, car, don't drive through my car.
How were they after it? I mean, obviously they said they were very bewildered, but I would imagine as well, Ruth, when you have an experience like that that is so outside the parameters of normality, is it one of those, I mean, did they ever sort of say the more they thought about it, the stranger it became? Or was it just one that they've kind of made peace with the fact that they just don't understand what happened?
Well, the curious thing I find is when somebody like you and I, who have a real interest in the paranormal, when we sit down and talk about it, we get into a longer and longer and longer conversation because we're both so fascinated by the subject. So we're interested in how did it feel? What did you think? What did you see? What did you do? All the ins and outs of it. I would say that 99.9% of my witnesses, I have to drag the story out of them because having sort of taken the brave step of writing to me or, you know, texting me or emailing me or whatever they've done, and said, actually, I've seen a ghost. When I then press them for details, they'll give me details about what they saw. But if I try to say to people, and how did that make you feel? What did you think of it afterwards? They don't really want to go down that route with me. It becomes too personal to talk about how they sort of felt inside. I am, after all, a stranger that they're writing to. I'm some author that they've heard of or heard speak on, you know, a podcast or a radio show or a TV show, whatever it might have been.
Mm.
To actually talk to me about their personal feelings is something people don't, in the majority, they don't seem to like to do. I do ask them, you know, how did you feel? Oh, you know, it's just one of those things. And they kind of shrug the question off a lot.
Mm.
I get that much more than people who are willing to say, oh my God, I was absolutely terrified and afterwards I couldn't this or I couldn't that, or, you know, this is how it made me feel for weeks afterwards or anything. People don't really like to go into the aftermath.
Mm.
And I think that's part of the whole, for most people who go through their daily lives not thinking much about the paranormal or don't believe in ghosts, don't believe in the paranormal, to suddenly be confronted with something that they cannot explain.
Mm.
And that in their hearts of hearts they know they experienced the way they're telling me, you know, like in this case, that car passed through their van.
Mm.
As they thought, oh my God, we're about to have a horrible accident. You can't explain that.
No.
You can't rationalize that away. You can't, like you said earlier, say, oh, perhaps it was a trick of the light. Perhaps it was a shadow that I mistook for something.
Mm.
Perhaps as I turned my head fast, I thought it was something and then it wasn't. There's more there, isn't there?
Yeah.
With people that have, you know, these, if you like, kind of bigger experiences.
Mm.
And that's not in any way belittling people who have, you know, things that are more fleeting.
Mm.
But it's almost like they're sort of, I'm willing to tell you that much because I was so fascinated to hear that you talk about these in a rational way and not all sort of, you know, too spooky dooky kind of thing. And you sound, yes, quite normal, so I'll talk to you. But I don't want to get into the feelings of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I can understand that because that's, you know, that's people's personal lives you're asking them to kind of expose to me. And at the end of the day, I am a complete stranger to them, you know.
Mm.
It's only occasionally that people are willing to talk about how they really felt about something.
Yeah. I suppose as well, because it's such a strange thing, I think some people are just very able to just put it to one side and move on. Because when we've spoken before, and we've talked about this, and I've spoken to other people because obviously they know where I'm interested in, I'm always amazed by people who will say, and you've mentioned this before on other shows and other interviews you've done, that people will say to you, oh, what do you do? And you tell them. And they go, oh, well, I don't believe in all that. But this one strange thing happened to me. And I remember speaking to somebody who was one of the most, he was so dead set that the paranormal was just all stuff and nonsense. And he said, well, there was this weird thing. And he told me this story about he was working somewhere on a house on his own. And he was working away there. There was nobody else in this house. He was fitting some, I think he was doing a banister, I think it was. It's been a while since I spoke to him about this. But as he was doing it, he kept hearing strange noises in the house. Lovely big house, very bright and airy. And all of a sudden this wind appeared from nowhere and sort of swirled around him and went round him and through his legs and around his body and under his arm and went.
Oh, wow.
And he just said, yeah, it was a bit strange. Like, a bit strange? What?
But that's the thing, isn't it? You know, if you're absolutely sure that you don't believe in the paranormal, then you are going to dismiss that as, well, it was a bit of an odd wind, and I'm not going to look any deeper into that because I don't believe in that.
Yeah.
But I think it's only, you know, people still ask me, do you believe in ghosts? And I still say, define ghost for me before I can answer that, because it depends what you're... In fact, funny enough, I had this conversation at lunchtime today. I was out lunchtime today with friends. I was telling them I just published the newest book. And one of them made a comment about, well, I don't see how, you know, if ghosts were a real thing, we'd be chock-a-block with ghosts, you know, because everybody dies and everybody... And I sort of said, well, you're making the assumption that ghosts are definitely the spirits of the dead. So that's one theory.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that may well be one aspect of it. But there's a lot of other that don't fit that.
Yeah.
So this is why I will still sit on the fence and say, well, tell me what your definition is. And then I can answer you as to whether I believe in that definition or not.
Yeah.
But my view is that, and remains even after all 6 books, even after all this research I've done, is that when somebody finally, much more intelligent than I am, sits down and works it out, I think there's going to be more than one answer.
Yes.
I think there's going to be, this type of haunting is explained by X, this type of haunting and paranormal occurrence is explained by Y, and this type is explained by G, and so on and so on. And there will be different categories and different reasons types of phenomena are happening. So, you know, whether you're seeing a ghost car that drives through you, or whether you've got poltergeist activity, whether it's a ghost plane, as we talked about earlier, they might fit into different categories of explanation.
Mm.
And it's just like saying, oh, we have weather. Yeah, we have weather. What does that mean? Well, it might rain one day. It might be sunny one day. It might snow. It's all weather.
Yeah.
But it has different ways of manifesting itself for different reasons under different conditions.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the paranormal is going to turn out to be.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been comfortable with one explanation, because I know enough about the paranormal and the variety of reports to know that it simply can't just be the ghosts of people, because, as we've just been saying, we've been talking about ghost vehicles.
Yeah, they're not a person. How would they didn't live and then die, you know? Yeah.
And not all ghosts, because there is this other thing that, oh, if you're a ghost, you must be trapped for some reason. It must be a tragic death. Well, we know that's not true as well.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then there'd be lots of ghosts wandering around, because sadly...
Because lots of people have tragic deaths, yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly. But then that doesn't explain, well, why do we get ghost animals? Why do poltergeists not appear then? Why do they just bang everything about and frighten people in the middle of the night, you know?
Yeah. Why is it so different? If there was one explanation, it would all fit into it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and it clearly doesn't. No, not at all. And it's not, as with anything in the world of the weird, it's not a one-size-fits-all. But you will often get situations where people will ignore things. And I think that's one of the reasons why people, when they do books about the Peak District and Derbyshire, Ruth, they don't want to touch ghost planes, because it doesn't fit in with lovelorn maidens throwing themselves off a cliff or whatever, or battles from the English Civil War. They can set that into a tangible piece of history or a legend where they can say, right, the reason this ghost is here because of this horrible thing happened. Well, yes, there's planes, but I don't want to talk about those, or ghost cars, or people that see ghost horses, or ghost cats, or ghost dogs. Then they don't want to touch it because they can't explain it, because it doesn't fit that preconceived idea. And even though they believe in ghosts, there are certain things they don't clearly believe in.
And I think it is, there is a certain amount of blinkered approach that, you know, what will fit in. And that goes back to, you know, what I said right at the beginning, when I was a kid trying to find the things to read, and all I could find was accounts of headless horsemen and clanking ghosts in castles and black monks. And yes, we do still have those. Lord knows you only need to read my books to find a few ghostly monks and a few headless horsemen and what have you.
Yes.
Well, not headless, to be fair. They do all have their heads. But, you know, they are still here. But that's not everything that's happening, and it's not the full story.
Mm.
And I think it's something, I think part of that explanation is something to do with the human need to sex the story up somehow.
Yes.
It's much better if you can say, oh, that noise that's heard up on those moors is, you know, the sounds of battle from the English Civil War battle, you know.
Mm.
But actually, if you went up there and recorded it, you know, would the sounds actually be that of a battle?
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard somebody give an explanation for what is said to be the sounds of Romans battling as, well, they must be mistaking it for the sound of the local firing range. Well, I'm sorry, I don't see how you can mistake a firing range, which is modern day firearms, with the sound of Romans fighting who didn't have firearms. So either you're listening to something that isn't Roman, if there's the sound of gunfire in it, or you're not paying attention to people saying that it's beating drums they're hearing, because you cannot say that a beating drum sounds anything like a firearm going off.
No.
You just can't. You know, that's really reaching for, oh, it's a vaguely percussive sound, it must be the same sound. That's rubbish. You know, it's a bit like saying rain is the same as snow. No, it's not. You know, they are both weather and they both involve water, but they're not the same thing.
No.
One is one manifestation of water and one's the other. Just because a percussive sound happens doesn't make it, you know, so easily explainable, does it?
No, very true. And it is strange, as we've spoken before, about certain locations, they'll say, oh, well, this is because of this, because they've got this historical event, and therefore whatever people are seeing has to be that. And I think these days, like, as we were once saying, and we were talking about it, the amount of people that claim they see roundheads and cavaliers wandering around the country. And then when you think, well, you clearly don't have that much knowledge about the English Civil War. You've got this dramatized version of it, because they didn't all walk about with big floppy hats and all have mustaches and stuff. A lot of them just wore normal clothes with a colour on it, didn't they? So
yeah, they didn't even have uniforms, most of them. It was only the very elite guards that had a uniform. The rest of them were just your ordinary farmers and, you know, locals that were sort of conscripted into it. And most of them were given a sash to wear. So if you were fighting for one side, you wore an orange sash. And if you were fighting for the other side, you wore a different coloured sash.
Yeah.
And that's how you knew not who not to stab, you know. They've got the same colour sash on as you, don't stab them.
Yeah.
But there weren't uniforms. And it's the same thing with, oh, I've seen, or there's a spirit that, you know, in this area that wears highwayman's clothes. So what exactly does a highwayman wear then? And of course, we're basing that description on films that have been made since, you know, the 1920s onwards, when films became a thing, where in most films where there's a highwayman in it, they're dressed in tight black, slightly sexy looking clothing. You know, perhaps a white ruffled shirt and a big hat, and you know, big long boots nearly up to their knees or just over the knee.
Yep.
And pistols strapped at their sides and probably a crossed over, you know, pistol holster type across their chest or something. I am absolutely sure if you went back and looked at a real highwayman from the 1600s, 1700s, whatever, he was probably just wearing ordinary peasant type clothing, but kept it in a dark colour so he blended in with the night.
Yeah.
They weren't trotting off down to the local highwayman clothing store or wearing the same thing. It's that need to fit things into niche and fit things into, oh, well, it must be something a bit more romantic, a bit more sexy. It's like, you know, the ghost of Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
Or the ghost of so-and-so. How do you know what so-and-so looked like?
Yeah.
Whoever it is, you know. There's so many out there. Oh, we've got the ghost of Dick Turpin. Show me a picture of Dick Turpin then. And then tell me that your ghost looked like that. You know, it's like, so many of these sort of accounts ascribe a name to it that's known.
Yeah.
And I would argue, I absolutely accept that people are experiencing something and seeing something, but don't try and push it to bend it to fit into a niche that you're then going to be happy to talk about, you know, that it's Dick Turpin rather than just some poor local vagabond that took to highway manning as a profession for what reason, either, you know, laziness, couldn't be bothered to get a job, or more likely hardship, you know, and was forced to turn to that way of life because there was nothing else to sustain. They're not going to be outfitted in sexy tricorn hats and black clothing and so on. It's all a bit, it's trying to push things into things they're not, or see something that's perhaps not there, you know.
Yeah, I would imagine if they've turned to highwaymen, they wouldn't be able to afford big leather boots anyway. And if they were robbing people for their boots, I think that there's an issue there that they need to address, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in one of the stories in Roadmap 2, I won't go into huge detail, but that was about, you know, there's supposed to be these two highwaymen seen galloping away from a particular village. And all the legends, everywhere you look and read about it, they're always listed as members of this particular gang. Can't remember the name of the gang off the top of my head. So I started trying to see, well, why were they galloping along this bit of road then, if they're in this gang, which was from somewhere a few miles away?
Mm.
And when I really looked into it, actually, these two individuals that it's supposed to have been were tried at the same assizes as that gang were.
So they weren't even part of the gang?
They weren't part of the gang. They were tried at the same assizes. And people writing about it since have assumed that meant they were in the same court case like you would have today, and therefore they were part of the gang. And they've misunderstood the part that back then there wasn't such a thing as a central court system. There was only the assizes. And the assizes was like a travelling court, if you like.
Yep.
It travelled from one location to another. So if it happened to be in, say, Nottingham this week, then all the villains that they'd imprisoned in Nottingham for the last year were all hauled in front of it to be sentenced and tried and so on. And so at this particular village, when the assizes came past, you know, there were 10 people tried at the assizes on that location, five of whom were members of this gang. But the other two were these two lads that had stolen from this village that they're seen galloping away from. So the poor lads have been vilified throughout history as the ghosts of two highwaymen, when in actual fact they were the ghosts of two robbers who had nothing to do with this gang of highwaymen, you know? And it is that sort of, it's easier to just describe it to, oh, they must be, I think it was the Culworth gang. They must be part of that gang. No, they were just two vagabonds. And if their ghosts are still haunting, it's probably because, you know, they did something awful and were caught for it. I ramble on.
Well, talking about ascribing things, one of the other locations that jumps out to me is this very strange place, Gidley, the Blackerton Brook Bridge, which is one of those, Ruth, where once again people say, oh, well, it's probably down to the Civil War. And you're like, what?
Yeah, do you know, this one, I really liked this one because it was such trial and tribulation to track it down. I'd come across somewhere or other, I can't even remember where now, a brief mention that the Blackerton Bridge near Gidley in Devon was haunted by the ghost of a lady who had thrown herself off the bridge and drowned, and also sometimes the sounds of battle. So I'd gone out looking to see if I could find anything more modern about that. But in order to go out on social media and ask people, have you seen anything down such and such a road, I need to be able to say where the road is, obviously. So I naively thought, because it's, you know, in all the accounts I'd seen of it, you know, Blackerton Bridge near Gidley, haunted by this lady that's thrown herself off. I naively thought that Blackerton Bridge would be easy to find. It's not. When you look into it, Blackerton Brook winds its way, literally almost turning in circles. It is so windy.
Mm.
And it goes past Gidley, but pretty much on three sides of it, in all sorts of loops and swirls and what have you. And there are numerous parts where roads cross it that have bridges. And it's only quite a narrow brook. Now, it may well run much deeper in winter, I'm sure, with being in Devon and, you know, gets the runoff and so on.
Yeah.
But it's hard to imagine that in many places it would be deep enough for somebody to throw themselves off a bridge and drown in it. And I couldn't find anywhere that would suggest that a particular bridge over it was called Blackerton Bridge. So then I turned to, well, what about if I look up the Civil War battle? Perhaps that'll tell me something. I was able to find historical record that they're not sure entirely where the Civil War battle took place, which is fair enough because, of course, centuries have passed in between.
Yeah.
And there are two locations that the archaeologists have narrowed it down to, two possible locations, one of which they have a map drawn of that was drawn some 30 or 40 years, I think, after the Civil War. So likely to have some measure of accuracy to it. And that clearly shows the battle as having taken place next to Blackerton Bridge.
Mm.
So when I compared that map to modern day maps, I was able to pin down which road that was on. Then I was able to use Google Maps to look at the bridge, which today is a tiny little narrow lane that passes over a tiny little, looks like it's made of concrete bridge with a little tiny bit of iron work alongside. It's not even a proper railing or anything. It's just like those spikes you sometimes see along farmers' fields, you know, that sort of old spike thing.
Mm.
And it certainly doesn't look like it's high enough, deep enough, or anything for anybody to have thrown themselves off and get anything more than a sprained ankle. So I would have been pretty much ready to write it off at that point as just some old legend, but I, due diligence, I found out where it is, or I'm pretty sure it was. So I write out on social media and I get one lady who writes back and says, well, she's never seen anything along there, but her horses are always spooked if she tries to take them along there.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Then a lovely lady wrote to me who was in her 80s who said, oh, it's funny you should be asking about that. She said, I used to live around there when I was a girl. So we're going back, you know, 70 years, probably 60, 70 years.
Yeah.
She said, and I used to have to ride to Chagford, I think it was, the next village over. I used to have to go there to go to the shop sometimes. And I would either borrow the farmer's pony and ride down there, or I'd bicycle down to the next thing. She said, and I never liked going down that bit of lane. She said, I can't really say. She said, it just struck me. I wouldn't even have thought of it so many years ago. She said, but you asked about it, and I can now that I'm thinking about it, I can remember it's clearly how much I didn't like going down that bit of lane. It always made me feel uncomfortable. It was eerie.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, oh, well, perhaps this is one of these hauntings then that's kind of faded out and now it's only picked up as a feeling.
Mm.
But then a lady wrote to me and she doesn't even carry a phone with the internet on it. She doesn't do the internet. She only had to borrow a friend's computer to email me because somebody had seen my post, knew of her story because she talked to them about it and asked her to get in touch with me. So it was a bit of Chinese whispers to get to this lady who doesn't really do the internet or anything.
Yeah.
She did write to me with her story, and it happened in August 2021. Mm. So recently. And she had gone for a walk and was walking through the woods by there. There's some, you know, open to the public woods that you can walk through. And she'd popped out onto this lane that crosses Blackerton Bridge. She'd walked along the lane for a while, beautiful, hot, sunny Sunday afternoon, enjoying her stroll. Walked along it for a little while, then turned around and started walking back again. And as she's walking back, so you can imagine this little leafy lane in Devon, obviously very twisty, turny, but fairly level ground there. So as it twists and turns, you can kind of see across the turns, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Through the foliage. And she notices walking towards her down the lane, but still some distance off, a figure dressed in a monk's cowl. Very clearly a monk's type cowl, hood up, cloak reaching all the way to the floor. Couldn't see their hands, she said, but it looked like they had their hands clasped in front of them. And she assumed that it was somebody either off to a fancy dress or whatever, and that they'd got their mobile phone clasped in their hands, hidden by the folds of the cloak. And that's what they were staring intently down at. That she just assumed it was someone real.
Yeah.
So she and this figure are walking towards each other, but around these twisting bends. So at times the figure's coming into view and out of view and into view and out of view as it goes around the bends and trees intervene and so on. They get closer and closer, and she starts to get a feeling of somehow inherent wrongness about it. And she starts looking at it a bit more closely and realises that she can make out the rosary beads round its neck, because it's now close enough, wooden beads, but still can't see the face. The face is just completely in shadow inside the hood. And at this point she starts to think, but I should be able to see something of a face by now. We're close enough if I can see the beads. At that point the figure moves out of sight behind a tree, as, you know, the bend of the road with sort of trees in between. And she's watching, and it just never reappears the other side of the tree. And at that point, she realised that what had been striking her as wrong was that as she was watching and sort of trying to see why she couldn't see the face, bits of the figure were kind of stripping off and floating off.
Oh.
Like it was kind of almost melting in front of her.
Yeah.
And as it passed behind this tree, it was almost as if it just finished melting away and had gone. And she said, I can't really describe to you how it looked, but that's the best I can manage. And there was nothing there. There was nobody there. So what she'd taken for a real person, as she watched it at first, she watched it for, you know, a good minute or two as they sort of walked, probably even 2 or 3 minutes, as they kind of walked towards each other around the bends of this lane.
Yeah.
And again, perfectly warm, sunny, bright sunshine afternoon, just out for a stroll, and she encounters something like that. So whatever it is that haunts around that Blackerton Bridge doesn't appear to be a lady who throws herself off the bridge, but there is definitely something going on down it.
Yeah.
And this, yeah, boys and girls, is why research pays off.
Well, she's one of the witnesses as well that said she was really shaken by this. I think, as you describe, when you see something so clear, once again, middle of the afternoon, a lovely day, lovely location, and then you come across something that just vanishes in front of your eyes, it completely challenges everything about you.
Yeah.
And what you understand about where you live and the area you walk. I would imagine she's probably walked up and down these little windy lane for years, Ruth. And yeah, she's never, and it just happened to be she was in the right place, as I've said before. Some people would say the right place at the right time. She clearly thought it was the wrong place at the wrong time, because she didn't really appreciate it. But also, I found very interesting about this particular witness is she'd had a couple of other strange events, which I'd heard of something similar. Paul Sinclair, the researcher who lives out in East Yorkshire, had a very similar incident, because I think she was walking somewhere and she felt as though somebody grabbed her bag and pulled her back?
Yeah, this was at a nearby, not far from here, from this point, I think over towards Chagford Way.
Mm.
She'd gone in to have a look at a little churchyard and was coming out through the gateway. And as she got a little backpack on her back, as she often does when she goes out for her strolls, and something tugged, pulling her backwards. And she actually thought she'd caught it on a branch or, you know, whatever, and sort of turned to look. But there was absolutely nothing anywhere near her that could have snagged it, and yet whatever it was had pulled it sharply enough to kind of pull her backwards. She hurried away from that spot and thought, I can't explain that. And it does challenge your view of reality, you know.
Yeah, because Paul was doing something similar. He was somewhere, I think he was with his wife and his dog. He was taking his dog for a walk, and they were investigating a particular area for some reports of strange things being seen around there, Ruth. And the same thing happened to him. He was walking through something, and he was literally pulled back.
Yeah.
And there was nothing that he could have caught his coat on or his bag or anything. He was literally physically pulled backwards. So, weird.
It is weird. And until you experience it yourself, something like that, it's hard to understand how it can happen. But then when you do, and all you listeners out there, trust me, at some point in your life, something like this will happen. And that will be the day when you think, I can't explain that. I can't wrap my head around how that fits into what I know and believe of the universe around me. It doesn't fit.
Mm.
So, yeah, and those are the days that people then, you know, when somebody like me comes out saying, have you ever experienced? And it will trigger that memory and say, well, actually, yes, I did, and I still can't explain it.
Yeah, very true. I think one of the other places that jumps out to me is primarily because of what it's called. and the place it's near. This is like a double win here, Ruth, which is Troy Town Forest, which is near Puddle Town.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
You don't need to in this country.
You really don't need to in this country. We have just the most amazing place names, don't we? And yes, there really is a Troy Town Forest near a place called Puddle Town, which, you know, it's and the particular ghost for this one was the Aether. It's not that far from Dorchester, Poole, that area, and it's the A35. And I'd come across an account that there's a ghostly figure sometimes seen along this bit of the A35, and that the figure that has been seen is this. Seems to be a chap standing in the road wearing a triangular shaped hat with a pair of pistols strapped at the waist. So very much that typical highwayman dress that we were talking about a little while ago. I did obviously go out, as I always do, looking for correlations. Nobody came back who'd seen anything along this particular stretch, but I got several others for other roads. So I sort of did the usual search elsewhere, and I did find an article from October 2020, where somebody else had written in because they'd found that original encounter that I've just mentioned. And they said that they were getting on to the A35 on the slip road by Troy Town when they saw a person on a horse there and thought it was a real person on a horse for a minute. So sort of slowed down and, you know, out of courtesy, like you would do if you saw a horse and rider. But as he did that, he sort of looked properly at them and suddenly realised he was looking at what he thought might be a roundhead soldier from the English Civil War, you know, wearing sort of, you know, the metal skull cap that we all think of with that.
Yeah.
And he said that just for that a fleeting moment, it looked like the figure looked at him before just disappearing. The figure and the horse just disappeared. So I haven't found any witnesses that came to me for it, but there are those two more recent ones that are out there already, you know.
I mean, this is the thing, that both of those witnesses clearly thought they were seeing something tangible and real because of how they reacted to that specific interaction.
Absolutely.
So if you perhaps think you might see, you know, shadows or something, you're not going to mistake someone sat on a horse. This is not a trick of the light, Ruth.
Well, no. I mean, you can't imagine many shadows that are going to look like a horse and rider that you actually slow your car down thinking it's a real horse and rider.
Yeah.
You know, for a moment, whatever he saw looked like a real live, you know, horse and rider that he needed to give usual road etiquette to, you know.
Yeah.
Before it did the weird thing of disappearing.
Well, that's the thing about some of these road ghosts. They love to just vanish into thin air, which is always striking when people pass them and then they look back and they've gone. And I think one of the last ones I want to touch on is this very strange story of a coach driver on the, I think it's the A34 near Abingdon in Oxfordshire.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is one of those where he's not on his own as well. He's got passengers with him. And they all see the same thing.
Well, certainly the three passengers that were nearest him certainly confirmed that they'd seen it.
Mm.
So absolutely more than one witness. So this is somebody who wrote to me. This is one of my own witnesses. He saw this about 15 years ago. So we're thinking 2005, 2006, something like that.
Yep.
It made him so interested in the subject that he became a ghost hunter himself, which is how come he came across my work, of course, and decided to write to me.
Yeah.
At that time, he was working as a coach driver for a coach company which catered for these week-long coaching holidays, if you know the sort of thing I mean. And this particular week, he was taking out one of these week-long tour of passengers around Oxfordshire, following all the sites that had been part of that popular TV series Inspector Morse.
Mm-hmm.
So they were having like a Morse week or whatever. And this particular evening, he was driving his coach load of people that he'd been driving around with all week down the A34, heading towards the M4. He can't now remember exactly where he was along the A34, but he's pretty sure he was south of Abingdon, so somewhere along that stretch. Daylight's starting to fade, you know, it's sort of early evening, when ahead of him, from the side of the road, which was tree-lined at this point, what he thought was a figure stepped out into the road in front of the coach. and it was only about a car's length or so ahead of him, so he immediately knew he had no hope of stopping a coach full of passengers in that short distance.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, he did, you know, he does what you've got to do, he stamps on the brakes, and even as he's doing that, even as he's making the reaction, he realises that the figure isn't right, it's almost translucent.
Mm.
And he said, the best he can describe to try and get me to understand what he was seeing was, if you imagine a net curtain blowing in the wind and how that looks as it ripples.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see through it, but there is an opaqueness to it as it ripples, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's what he was seeing as the figure in that few seconds he had as he tried to brake because it stepped out so close to the coach, and it actually hit the, or appeared to hit the front of the coach.
Mm.
And then instantly disappeared. But the three passengers at the front of the coach, one of them had said, what the hell was that sort of thing? So he did the right thing and he pulled over onto the hard shoulder, and they got out and they went back and looked, you know, try and make sure there wasn't something he'd hit or whatever. Couldn't find anything in the road, like a plastic bag or, you know, something that might have kind of explained what happened. But they did find one of these roadside shrines that are quite popular in the UK.
Yes.
You know, where there has been a road accident and the family leave a shrine there, sometimes for many, many years. Some of these shrines are years and years old.
Yeah.
He said that at that point they beat a hasty retreat and left. Because I thought, oh, we might actually have seen the ghost of whoever that was. So.
Mm. But then there's a really good sort of epilogue to this one, which is the fact that somebody else on a, is it a motorbike or a moped, was driving down the same stretch of road, and they thought they saw somebody stood in the road having a cigarette.
Yeah,
and the fact that they could smell the cigarette smoke.
Yeah, because they were on a moped, and at this point the A34, they must have been on a big enough moped to be able to ride on it, but he was actually standing in the road, so they kind of had to ride round him almost, and were close enough, obviously, with being, you know, on a small motorbike, moped, whatever, with, you know, just a open crash helmet on. Yeah. You could smell the cigarette as you go past. And it was only that he happened to look in his rearview mirror on the bike, thinking, he's going to get hit if he stands there in the middle of the road. Should I stop and tell him to move or something?
Mm.
And he looks behind him, and the figure's completely disappeared. It's not there. So until that point, he thinks he's passed a real person who's standing for some bizarre reason smoking a cigarette in the road.
Mm.
Yeah. Again. Keep your eyes peeled, people. You never know.
Well, it's the added ingredient of being able to actually smell cigarette smoke. It's such a distinctive aroma, and anybody that's quit smoking will be able to, can smell cigarette smoke from miles away.
Absolutely.
It is such a distinctive smell, Ruth, that it's not something you can mistake.
No, and it's not a smell that you would have just wafting across an open bit of countryside. No. There would have to be a smoker nearby for you to get that smell, wouldn't there?
Yeah. Oh, dearie me. Yeah. Just be aware. You never know what's around each corner, it would seem.
Quite literally, yes.
I think before I let you go, is there any story in this, Ruth? Because often, you know, we can be quite churlish about this, that we deal with some of these situations and speak to people, and we hear some stories that might make us get goosebumps or raise the hairs on the back of our necks. Is there any particular story in here that you found particularly creepy?
That's a good question, because, you know, actually, there were quite a few of them that gave me creeps in this one. I think it's the ones where people are least expecting it.
Mm.
And it happens during the daytime are the ones that get me the most.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot. I seem to have a lot of accounts of ghosts stepping out in front of cars in broad daylight and then disappearing. And that always gives me a bit of a chill, I have to admit, because, you know, like you say, if it's late at night and it's dark and you've got the headlights and you may be a bit tired, you know, or perhaps not at your best in the evening, even if you're used to night shift or whatever, you know, our body clocks are a bit more sluggish in the evening. You can maybe take some safety in a way, and oh well, it might just have been a trick of the light, or it might just have been a mistake, or it might. But when somebody sees a full figure step out in front of them in broad daylight, sometimes in queues of traffic,
yeah,
and then disappear before it reaches the other side of the road, they're the sort of things that just they will put a shiver up my spine, I must admit. So yeah, I think you'll find a few of them in this book.
Well, it's chock full of fabulous stories once again from all over the United Kingdom. There are plenty to set you on high alert whenever you decide to take a trip anywhere. I don't think anywhere in the UK is safe, it would seem. So what's next for you, my love? I know, obviously, jokingly, I don't want to put you down because the book's only been out a fortnight, so I'm not going to say what are you doing next, because you deserve a damn good rest after collating this latest collection, I would suspect.
Well, you know, I say that every year, that I'll take a break. and here I am, the lie to myself, because I published my first book in January 2017, and here we are 6 books in, and it's, what, October 22, so...
Yeah.
And my databases are groaning again at the seams. so I can feel myself already starting to itch to start sorting out what's in there and get my teeth into it. So I'm swaying at the moment between, I think that there's almost certainly going to be a These Haunted Times Volume 3.
Yeah.
But I also quite fancy writing a ghosts about elsewhere than the UK. Because I've had a couple of stories sent to me from elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I'd quite like to get my teeth into a few other places as well as the UK. So that might be in the offing. I might do a more generic, either a world ghost or I might even sort of pick a theme and go with ghosts around the world that fit into that theme, say, or something. Yeah. But yes, I definitely think there'll be a These Haunted Times 3 in the offing as well.
Marvellous.
So watch this space, people.
I shall set my clock now for next year.
Yeah.
No pressure, Ruth. So, my love, as always, where can everybody find your work, get this book, get any of the other ones they may have missed, and follow your work online?
So all my books are available on Amazon, so you can get them in paperback, ebook, or if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can read them for free. There's quite a lot of other booksellers do sell them as well, so Google and you'll find them. My full name is Ruth Roper Wilde, and the Wilde is spelt slightly oddly, W-Y-L-D-E. So that's also my email address. So it's just Ruth Roper Wilde, all no spaces, no dots, anything, at gmail.com, which makes it nice and easy to get in touch with me with your stories. I'm on Twitter under the same, so you can get me Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn under the same, so you can get me that way as well. But please, please, please send your stories, because that's what keeps the books churning.
Marvellous. I'll put links to everything, as always, in the show notes. Thank you, as always, for rejoining me, especially for my Halloween edition, Ruth. I couldn't have thought of anybody else I'd rather chat to at this time of year than yourself. And you always make time for me. It's always an absolute pleasure. Never regretted reaching out to you, although, I'll say all those years ago, it's about 2, but time flies when you're having fun.
It does.
So thank you, as always, once again, for your time, your trouble, and I look forward to our next conversation.
As do I. Always a pleasure.